Michael Shermer, the founder and founding publisher and editor-in-chief of Skeptic magazine. You can see his column every month in Scientific American. And his most recent book is Why Darwin Matters, The Case Against Intelligent Design. But he's been doing a lot of thinking and writing about the boundaries between religion and science as well. Shermer.
Good afternoon. I brought a case of the latest issue of Skeptic magazine for you. Be sure and take one on the way out there. This one on medical controversies. Does vaccinations cause autism? These sorts of things. Finally, this is the first time in like 2 years we've gotten away from the God question. Our readers would love every issue of Skeptic to be the special God atheism issue of Skeptic. We do try to branch from that. We did one on 9/11 conspiracy theories, that it wasn't Al-Qaeda, it was the Bush administration that did this. The people who believe this, by the way, think Bush is the most incompetent president we've ever had. But somehow he managed to pull off the most incredible conspiracy of all time. I do want to take a moment, too, in case no one else does it, since I've been involved with the Science Network since the beginning, to thank our organizer and sponsor, Roger Bingham, and Rob Zepps, who sponsored this. Thank you. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Roger. This is just too much fun. So, well, a couple of comments on what we've heard so far. The Newsweek statistics on people that believe, you know, psychics can talk to the dead, that sort of thing. Of course, those haven't really changed for the last 30 years. It's just the particular claims of what the paranormal is change. And I should point out parenthetically that anybody can talk to the dead. It's getting the dead to talk back. That's the hard part that we have explaining. Last year at Beyond Belief 1, I guess we'd call it, which did end up being something of an atheist love fest. It's true, but I think that's okay because we are something of a, if not beleaguered minority, certainly heavily surrounded by those who are theists. And so, I mean, we are social primate species, so we do need to communicate and commune with others, fellow like-minded people. That's one of the reasons we enjoy being together on things like this. And, we put on a monthly science lecture series at Caltech through the Skeptics, and pretty much everybody comes, not just for the lecture, but for the beer and pizza afterwards, because, you know, it's fun to hang out with people that are like-minded, and that's just perfectly normal. And I guess since that conference, I got to thinking about what are we? What do we call ourselves? This whole business of are we atheists or agnostics or non-theists or non-believers or brights or whatever the right term is. Anyway, I finally found one on a bumper sticker that said militant agnostic. I don't know, and you don't either. And I thought, hey, maybe that's the best summation of this enlightenment concept. I suppose addressing, as I did in Scientific American on my column on rational atheism, I mean, I'm an atheist, and I love reading Dan's book and Sam's books and Richard and Christopher. I have Richard and Christopher's books on audio tape, and my daughter and I listen to them on the way to school. They're terrific listening and reading. I guess so. I'm in the club, but my concern is, and where I want to go today with this, is the larger problem of tribalism. We are a social primate species. We practice within group cooperation and altruism and pro-social behavior. And within groups, we can be reasonably good primates. But between groups, we're fairly xenophobic, bellicose, pretty nasty. And everybody knows this. This is true. And so by simply dividing ourselves up and calling ourselves atheists, that, you know, we're sort of putting ourselves in another group. It's almost inevitable when so many around you are theists, if you don't, to call yourself something like that. But in reality, it isn't anything to join. It really isn't. It's like being an a-Bigfootist. I simply don't believe in Bigfoot, but, you know, it's not a big issue in our culture, so there's no reason to have a term for it. But in principle, I don't think it's any different from that. It isn't something we're for. It's just something we just don't happen to believe. So, what's the other term? You don't care. Apatheist. Yeah, I just don't care. Something like that. I guess where I concluded that column on rational atheism, as long as the principle of freedom or liberty is at work there, that we should have the right to believe or disbelieve whatever we want, as long as it doesn't interfere with the rights of other people to believe or disbelieve whatever they want, the basic fundamental principles of the American Declaration of Independence and Constitution. And I think the best social structure to allow that to happen is a liberal democracy and a free market capitalism, and that's what I want to talk about today. That is, I don't really care what anybody believes, as long as there's a social structure in place that prevents them from killing me, harming me, interfering with my personal life. And of course, that's the problem, isn't it? And so the issue is not if we can just educate out of everybody on the planet paranormal, supernatural beliefs, then that would solve the problem. I don't think that's ever going to happen. Despite the increase in circulation of Skeptic magazine, I don't think we're going to educate people out of this. I think better would be to simply structure society in a way that they can't bother us and hurt us, that sort of thing. The characteristics of that include a political state based on the rule of law. That includes property rights, a secure and trustworthy banking and monetary system, economic stability, a reliable infrastructure, the freedom to move about the country, freedom of the press, freedom of association, education, protection of civil liberties, and a clean and safe environment. We know from research by economists and there's a correlation between that and trust in a society, and a correlation between trust and those particular characteristics. So what I want to get at to in this is something of a little bit of an excerpt from my next book, which is called The Mind of the Market. It's on evolutionary economics. So picking up where David left off, talking about these major transitions, here is a major transition. And I'll just read from my opening page of the book. Living along the Orinoco River that borders Brazil and Venezuela are the Yanomamo people, hunter-gatherers whose average annual income has been estimated at the equivalent of about $100 per person per year. If you walked into a Yanomamo village and counted up all the stone tools, baskets, arrow points, arrow shafts, bows, cotton yarn, cotton and vine hammocks, clay pots, assorted other tools, various medicinal remedies, pets, food products, articles of clothing, and the like, you'd end up with a figure of around 300. Before 10,000 years ago, this was the approximate material wealth of every village on the planet. So if our species is roughly 100,000 years old, let's say, order of magnitude, back of the envelope calculation, then about 90% of our history was spent in this state of relative economic simplicity. By contrast, living along the Hudson River that borders New York and New Jersey are the Manhattan people, consumer traders whose average annual income has been estimated at $40,000 per person per year. If you walked into the Manhattan Village and counted up all the different products available at retail stores and restaurants, factory outlets, and superstores, you'd end up with a figure of around 10 billion as measured in stock keeping units, or the little barcode measures of products available in retail stores. This is a difference of 400 times in income and 33 million times in products, and that difference almost beggars description. If ever there was a great leap forward, and that's what I call it sort of ironically, this was it, and it didn't happen gradually. It's been estimated that the $100 per person annual income only rose to about $150 per person by 1000 BC and did not exceed $200 per person annum until after AD 1750 and the onset of the Industrial Revolution. In other words, it took 97,000 years to go from 100 to 150 bucks a head per year, then another 2750 years to climb to $200 per person per year, and finally 250 years to ascend to today's level of $6,600 per person per year for the entire world, and of course much higher in certain areas and much lower in others. If we compress that 100,000 year period into just 1 year, then the last 250 year period of relative prosperity would represent less than one day out of the year. Or if we condense the 100 millennium into one 24-hour day, our epic of industrial production and market economies denotes a mere 3.6 minutes. In other words, the age in which we live and have grown accustomed and take as normal, in fact, denotes a mere 0.25% of the history of humanity. How did this great leap forward happen? So my entire book attempts to answer that question. In short, I use evolutionary thinking along the lines of David's approach, that and evolutionary economics is roughly the field that addresses this, although behavioral economics, neuroeconomics also plays a role. And I apply what I do for a living, studying irrationality in human behavior, to the marketplace. People are just as irrational when it comes to money as they are pretty much everything else they do. The ability to predict the stock market, the people that do that are about as good at it as astrologers and tarot card readers. Anyway, that's a different lecture. So where I go is with this the evolutionary basis that we are a social primate species. We practice within group amity and between group enmity, roughly speaking. And that we have to begin with some means of developing trust between strangers, particularly between strangers between groups. Since most of our history was spent amongst people in groups in which we were either related to one another or knew one another, this was not so much an issue as it is between groups. So for between within group and between group interactions, we are greatly shaped by the perceptions of others, especially our perception of what they think of us. And then I talk about the need for reputation and why we care about our reputation, which is why ratings of sellers' reputations on eBay, rankings of quality of reviewers' assessments on books of books on Amazon, and the quality and quantity of connections between users as a measure of reputation in social and professional networking sites, MySpace, Facebook, LinkedIn, and so on. These evolve from the bottom up, these sort of self-organized principles of developing trust metrics between strangers. So we want to be thought of as fair and honest dealers, yet we're also exceptionally tribal, and group identity is essential to our sense of self. The unfortunate byproduct of this in-group, out-group tribalism is xenophobia, and we have a natural aversion to others, the Crips and the Bloods, the Hutus and the Tutsis, the Albanians and the Serbs, the Shiites and the Sunnis, the theists and the atheists, take your pick. We're just really naturally good at that. So for all that vast period of time before the rise of market capitalism and trade that allowed those sorts of barriers to break down, our folk economic intuitions are not to trust people that are wealthy, not to trust systems that show a great disparity between wealth and poverty. Those are counterintuitive and so new that there's no way we can naturally feel comfortable about that. And that's been the problem, I contend, amongst my libertarian brethren, of why people don't accept market economics intuitively, because it isn't intuitive, it's counterintuitive. Not so different from trying to explain the bottom-up system of design, complex design in nature. It's much easier and more intuitive to think of as it simply a top-down designer made it that way. We have vast experience of intelligent, semi-intelligent designers like us making things. We have no experience of watching nature do this sort of thing until somebody points it out. So the psychology behind diffusing intergroup aggression involves the process of turning potentially dangerous total strangers into prospectively helpful honorary friends. This is enabled through the creation of social institutions that encourage, enable, and enforce positive social interactions that lead to trust. One of the most powerful of these forms of interaction is trade, the effects of which I want to elevate to a principle based on an observation by the 19th century French economist Frederick Bastiat, where goods do not cross frontiers, armies will. Bastiat's principle not only helps us understand how hunter-gatherers made the transition to consumer traders, it also illuminates one of the primary causes of conflict, and its corollary elucidates one of the principles toward conflict resolution, where goods do cross frontiers, armies will not. Well, this is a principle, not a law, because there are exceptions, obviously, historically and today. Trade will not prevent war, but it attenuates its likelihood. Trade between groups increases the probability that peaceful and stable relationships will continue and decreases the probability that instabilities and conflicts will erupt. So returning to the Yanomama, where we began, and how they evolved into Manhattan consumer traders. When missionaries first began working with the Yanomama, they discovered that when they provided the native peoples with tools for the procurement and production of food and other resources, the amount of Yanomama inter-village fighting was greatly decreased. The great Yanomama ethnographer Napoleon Chagnon originally gave the Yanomama their fierce people moniker. You'll note in his later editions he drops the subtitle, the fierce people, because he realized that that's too simple and people were oversimplifying that. Anyway, Napoleon discovered that the Yanomama were not only fierce warriors, they were also sophisticated traders. And they did so because trade creates political alliances. So following the political dictum, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, Yanomamo inter-village trade and reciprocal food exchanges serves as a powerful social glue in the creation of political alliances. Village A cannot go to Village B and announce that they're worried about being conquered by the more powerful Village C, since this would reveal their own weakness. Instead, Village A forms an alliance with Village B through trade and reciprocal feasting. And as a result, they not only gain military protection, but it also encourages inter-village peace. As a byproduct of this politically motivated economic exchange, even though each Yanomamo band could produce all the SKUs it needs for survival, they often set up a division of labor and a system of trade. This is one example of the invisible hand metaphor, which unfortunately has multiple uses now. So when someone throws out a critique of the invisible hand, I'm not sure what you mean by that. But this is one example of the invisible hand, unintended consequences. The Yanomamo trade not because they're innate altruists or they're nascent capitalists, but because they want to form political alliances. Chagnon writes in his ethnography, without these frequent contacts with neighbors, alliances would be much slower in formation and would be even more unstable once formed. A prerequisite to stable alliance is repetitive visiting and feasting, and the trading mechanism serves to bring about these visits. In other words, where goods cross Yanomamo frontiers, Yanomamo armies do not. So although trade is not a surefire prophylactic for between-group conflict, it is an integral component to establishing trust between strangers that lessens the potential volatility. We know from behavioral research and neuroeconomic research on this now, in two different sources, fMRI brain scans of subjects inside one of those little tubes hitting a button, playing the prisoner's dilemma game, that the areas of the brain that light up when they're being very cooperative, when there's a lot of trust and cooperation going on, are the same regions activated in response to such stimuli as desserts, money, cocaine, beautiful faces. The neurons most receptive were those rich in dopamine, located in the anterior ventral striatum in the middle of the brain, the so-called pleasure center. This is assuming you're not skeptical of running an economic experiment inside a tiny little tube that you're crammed in, but that's another source of debate some other time. The neuroeconomists seem to agree that they're getting some value out of these. The reason I say this is because I went over and stuffed myself into one of these tubes and tried it, and it was about the most uncomfortable, unnatural experience I've ever had. But somebody doesn't mind being in there, I guess, and so the data they get, we are told, is valuable. So let's take it at that for now. Cooperative subjects reported increased feelings of trust toward and camaraderie with like-minded partners verbally. In research with subjects playing a version of the ultimatum game, that includes numerous exchanges, when trust is established and the cooperative mode is fully engaged by both trading partners, levels of oxytocin increased in the blood. This is Paul Zak's research at Claremont Graduate University. Paul has subjects playing these different games, the ultimatum game, iterated ultimatum game, the dictator game, prisoner's dilemma, and he draws their blood. And when there's a lot of cooperation and trust going on, there's a spike in oxytocin. Well, which is the causal vector? To test that, he did it the other way around, where he had subjects take a nose spray hit, and in the nose spray was oxytocin. Those subjects were more cooperative, offered more money, and so forth. Paul's research is really trying to get at the neurophysiology and hormone behind trust, and then therefore trade. And that's why we call this neuroeconomics. So the psychology of trade probably has as much to do with forming alliances between individuals and groups as it does the economics of trade in generating an increase in the supply of resources. Nevertheless, the end result of initial exchange activities is an increase in cooperation, mutual aid, and trust, which drives further trade and trust into a positive feedback loop that accentuates amity between people and attenuates enmity between groups, leading to greater peace and prosperity for more people in more places more of the time. And then to sort of wrap it up, I give lots and lots of examples in the book of other indigenous peoples groups following these principles as well as modern groups. And then sort of wrap up with talking about a trip I took in 2000 to Beijing for a scientific conference in which I went to visit the Forbidden City. And there in the Forbidden City, Starbucks had just opened a cafe, which was just too much. Anyway, I noted in my Scientific American column on this the power of science and economics jointly to bring together such disparate Eastern and Western cultures over a scientific discussion or a cup of coffee. I call this the Starbucks corollary to Bastiat's principle, where Starbucks cross frontiers, armies will not. That is, the free trade of products between peoples and open access to services across geographic borders obsoletes the necessity of political borders and thereby decreases the probabilities that armies will cross those borders. To the Starbucks corollary, I add the Google theory of peace, where information and knowledge cross frontiers, armies will not. That is, the free trade of information between peoples and open access to knowledge across geographic borders obsoletes the necessity of political borders and thereby decreases the probabilities that armies will cross them. A stirring example of this can be seen in Europe since the formation of the Treaty of Rome and the European Union, which integrated disparate and historically divided European nations under one economic umbrella, even one coin. Where once invasions and wars were commonplace throughout 1,000 years of European history, they are now unthinkable. Now, try it. Imagine Germany invading France and waging war upon her, say, this year or next year. Or imagine France motoring its armies through the Channel and then marching into London and declare the country French. What once made for dramatic literature now sounds like pulp fiction.
Yeah, it really does sound like fiction, Michael, actually. never would happen.
So the Wikification of the economy adds to the Google theory of peace in which the entire world economy may be practiced by and participated in by billions of people. And I think Wikipedia is the right metaphor or analog for this emerging economic phenomenon. It is an open source, peer-produced, mass-collaborated, bottom-up, self-organized, emergent property of millions and potentially billions of people choosing to build the modern equivalent of the Alexandrian Library, whose purpose it was to make the sum of the world's knowledge available to everyone in one location. I realize Google can be criticized for sacrificing some of their principles by making certain terms with the Chinese government to get in there. But in the long run, no dictator, demagogue, priest, president, or other pretender to power will be able to control the Googlefication, Wikification, eBayification, MapQuestification, YouTubeification, MySpaceification of information, knowledge, geography, personal relationships, markets, and the economy. Chinese bureaucrats can attempt to put all the firewalls and controls they want on a billion potential Chinese web surfers, but they'll never be able to prevent knowledge, products, and people from finding their way to those who seek them. Freedom finds a way. Thank you.